This is an ABC podcast.
I think one of the most fun things about the Olympics is that every 4 years you get to watch this sport that's really exciting and looks amazing, even though you might not really know anything about it. And the events at the Winter Olympics are like that. Australia, for obvious reasons, doesn't really have a huge culture around winter sports like Canada or Russia or the United States, which is why we don't have such a big medal tally compared to the summer events. This goes some way, I think, to explain the massive incredulity in Australia when Stephen Bradbury won the gold medal for the men's speed skating in 2002 in Salt Lake City. Now, you've probably seen the video. Stephen maintaining a careful distance at the back of the pack, and then, on the final lap, one competitor slips, and then suddenly all the other competitors, all of them, crash into each other and they go spinning across the ice, and Stephen just sort of effortlessly glides past them across the finishing line to win gold. And this is the kind of victory that naturally appeals to Australians, and so doing a Bradbury has entered the language to represent the idea of a seemingly effortless fluky victory. But there is one big unanswered question with all this. If this was all so effortless, how did Stephen Bradbury make it to the men's final of this elite sport in the first place? How much struggle went into putting him among the world's fastest speed skaters? Well, today you'll actually get to hear that backstory and understand just how much will and effort went into getting Stephen onto the starting line of that race in 2002. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Richard. Thanks for having me.
Whereabouts did you grow up?
I grew up in Western Sydney, a suburb called Lamia.
Is that out past Campbelltown?
Yeah, very close to Campbelltown. Right. And yeah, I used to spend a lot of time in the car with Mum driving me into either Canterbury or Blacktown ice rinks as a youngster.
Is this like a bush suburb back then when you were growing up there?
I wouldn't say bush, but it's not like it is out that way, Western Sydney now, which is basically built all the way out to Appin and all the way out to the Blue Mountains and every other direction. Sydney's pretty much full nowadays, isn't it?
So was there a fair bit of freedom in your childhood out in the outer burbs of Sydney then?
There was. It was a great place to grow up. You know, I remember riding my bike along the street with no hands on the handlebars and no helmet when I was 7 years old. The streets were quiet and my brother and I were basically allowed to roam and do whatever we chose.
When did you first strap on a pair of skates?
I first strapped on a pair of speed skates when I was 8 years old, which is the longer version, the long speed skating blades.
What's the difference between speed skating blades and the ones that I, the slightly slightly less serious ones that I was putting on when
There's a lot of differences, yeah. But the main difference is the width of the blade. The speed skate is a lot thinner, and the length of the blade, it's a lot longer. So I started speed skating at eight. Prior to that, my dad first put me on a pair of ice skates when I was about 3 years old. They've got photos of it, Mum and Dad. My mum still shows everyone the photos of me bawling my eyes out when I was three, first time on skates. I didn't skate again for about 3 years after that because I was traumatised.
Yeah, it is slightly terrifying. I think I put them on for the first time when I was 13 or something like that. And it is a little scary. You imagine your fingers are going to get chopped off and you see the ice and it's hard and you fall on your bum and it hurts.
You get like cold, you get wet.
All of that stuff. So you put the skates on at three and that was so horrible you didn't want to do it again for another 3 years after that.
Correct, yeah. And then, you know, I was watching my dad skate. He was the national champion in Australia in speed skating a couple of times back in the mid-60s. And I suppose in some ways, unfortunately for him, that was as far as the sport went. There was no world championships. It wasn't in the Olympics. And for him, it was more of a regular hobby rather than I'm training to see if I can be the best in the world. But my dad was very good in his day and I wanted to share in something that he was doing.
Did you have siblings who were doing it with you?
I did. I had my younger brother, Warren, and I spent many years training together, and he got very, very close to making the Olympic team as well, but unfortunately didn't quite get there.
So you put on speed skates at eight, you say. So you were you competitive by nature, or did you just enjoy the sport, or was it a mix of both of those things?
Oh, mate, I'm extremely competitive. Yeah. I don't like losing at anything. When I was playing Monopoly with my brother when we were kids, if he was winning, I'd cheat.
It's refreshing to hear you say that because it's most Australians go, oh no, I just like to, you know, I just like to muck around and do all that sort of stuff. So you were competitive right from the get-go with skating.
Yeah. You're supposed to go out of that sort of mindset when you get a bit, little bit older, though. It took somebody like Lance Armstrong a little bit longer, though, didn't it?
So when did you start skating competitively then? At eight, that young?
I started racing in the national championships the first time. I think I was 9 years old in the under-10s division. And I remember when I was 10, I won the under-13 national speed skating championships at 10 years of age. And the kid who got the bronze medal also finished last. Popular sport in Australia.
Oh, I see. Okay, sorry.
There's only two other kids in it.
Just doing the mess of that in my head. I don't know why I imagined a whole pack of kids doing it. So what made you so driven then? What made you driven to want to really go further than anyone else in your family?
Well, initially, I didn't realise the potential that I had as a speed skater. And my dad did. When I was 13, 14 years of age, he used to force me to go running and go cycling with him. The skating I had no problem with because every time I skated, I was getting a little bit faster and the speed was the draw card. I've always loved anything that goes fast. And that adrenaline that went with that kept me coming back for more, but I didn't necessarily enjoy pounding out 5-6 kilometres going running before school every day, which my dad used to make me do. And for a couple of years there, I massively resented him for it. I hated him for it.
At 14, you moved with your family to Brisbane. Now, Brisbane, I don't know if it's terribly famous for its giant plethora of ice skating rinks. I mean, we're getting into pretty warm weather once you're in Brisbane. Was there any ice skating or speed skating culture in Brisbane when you arrived at 14?
It's not exactly the centre of the speed skating universe, is it?
No.
But, when I was 14, I believe at that time I was ranked around about 11th or 12th in New South Wales, including all the men skaters. So there was actually quite a large population of speed skaters back then. There was sort of 150 or so speed skaters in the state in New South Wales. And then I moved to Queensland and suddenly I was number one in the state. So at the time it didn't seem like a very good move, and I wasn't happy about moving at all. And I spent a lot of time catching the bus back to Sydney, which was a hell of a hike down the Prince's Highway or the New England Highway. And as it turned out, some of the juniors out of the Ruse Club in Brisbane started to come up, and some of the other top skaters in Australia started to move to Brisbane to train with me as well.
Also, a scene started to slowly develop in Brisbane around you then?
Yeah, partly around me, but, you know, I wasn't the only catalyst in that. I was Australia's best 500-metre skater for many years. His name was Richard Nozelski. He moved here to pursue a business as well. And on the back of that, my brother was getting better. And there was two brothers in Brisbane, Andrew and Mark McNee, that both competed in a couple of Olympics each. And they started coming up into the national team as well. And it ended up being the sort of the epicentre of speed skating in Australia for probably a decade.
You know, Stephen, watching it as a sport, watching it, particularly at the elite level you were practicing at, it's an exciting sport. It's very exciting sport to watch.
Very television friendly, that's
very,
for sure.
But it's also very beautiful too. It's very beautiful. In fact, sometimes it doesn't even look like a competitive sport. It looks like some kind of strange team activity or something, because you all seem to know. You, there's the moments when you struggle and fight to get ahead, but for the rest of it, you're all sort of moving in the same way, almost like a flock of birds or something, going at incredible speeds and tilting right over just to the point where your hand will just gently tap the rink. I don't even know if it does, but it looks like it's you're tapping the rink or something as you're going around the corner.
It does. You know, it's a graceful sport, and if you're smooth and it looks relaxing, generally that also means fast. If you look like you're erratic and you're trying really hard, then generally that means slow. So once you get over on that angle of down to around about a 40-degree lean angle you can get to, you can actually pop your elbow down onto the ice when you lean over if you want to. But putting your fingers down onto the ice creates a little bit of a stability point. Once you lean over at that 40-degree angle, you put your fingers down and it gives you that little bit more control. And when you nail the exit of the corner, when your blades are gripping and you've got the bend and the radius and the angle and everything's tweaked and you come out of that corner, and just it can feel like you've been fired out of a slingshot coming out of the corner. If you've got the strength to push it and the G's lean over at 40 degrees, the feeling is incredible.
Yeah, it's a very gentle thing. It's just this gentlest tap. And then for, you know, part of the way around the lap, the skaters will have their hands behind their back. You look almost like dolphins, you know, cutting through water or something like that. It looks effortless almost. works, but of course it's not. All that strength is going into powering you around it. Watching it closely, the thing that struck me, I was trying to think why it's so appealing to look at, and I think it's quite dreamlike. I think I've had dreams like that where I move like that. It's that, it's that high velocity, frictionless forward motion. Does it feel as good as it looks to do?
I've got to tell you, Richard, I have a little bit of trouble nowadays because it's been so many years being able to remember exactly what that feeling was like. If you've been on the ice for 2 weeks, off the ice, sorry, for 2 weeks, you're so far away from that feeling of speed and smooth and driving out of the corner. But definitely I can remember what it was like. And it was, it's just exhilarating when everything comes together. The strength of the skater and the equipment set up and the drive out of the corner. It's an incredible feeling of doing over 50 kilometres an hour on a pair of speed skates and feeling comfortable and in control while you're doing it.
So you can feel that exhilaration because you're not like it's the concentration you're bringing to the sport, the concentration you need to have in order to sort of get past your competitors and all that. That doesn't get in the way of the kind of rush of pleasure that you feel in the sport as you're competing?
I don't know if the pleasure comes in so much when you're in a competitive situation. That's probably more when you're doing, when the ice conditions are optimal and you're going really fast in training. So when you're in a competitive environment, there's obviously a lot of other things that are going through your mind about, you know, when you're going to move, who's in front of you, who's behind you, and how much energy you're trying to save for the certain point of the race.
Have you tried ice skating across, like, the rinks are really quite small, actually. So have you tried ice skating at top speed across a giant, I don't know, frozen lake or something like that, a frozen pond or something
where you can
just go and go?
Yeah, I've done some skating on the canals in Holland in my time.
And how different is that experience to being on a rink?
Yeah, well, the way short track speed skating skates are set up, which is my sport, not long track, so most of the lap is on the corner rather than in a straight line, so you can't go as fast in a straight line in short track skates as you can turning because the G's and the acceleration out of the corner and the lean angle allow you to accelerate more. But skating on a canal where you can't see the end of it and you're outside in a natural environment is pretty fun.
Are you in danger of crashing into a barge or something if you're going at that speed along a canal in Amsterdam or something?
I don't know if you've ever heard of the event they have there in Holland, which hasn't run for a long time. It used to be called the 11 Cities Race, which is the largest sporting event in the country. And the canals, due to global warming, whatever you want to make of it, haven't frozen over that hard for many, many years. So I don't think they've run for about 17 or 18 years now.
How much of it is about the blades when you're going that fast?
Yeah, the equipment setup and mainly the blades is a huge part of the sport. There's a lot of science that goes into getting the bend, the angle, the radius and the offset all combining perfectly so you get the right amount of grip to be able to exit the corner as fast as you can. And the technology in setting up blades has improved markedly in the last decade or so, or since I finished the sport. It was a little bit more of a skaters having a shot at bending and hoping they got them correct, whereas the bending equipment has been fine-tuned a lot these days.
What does it feel like to be crammed into a pack as you're zooming around the corners like that, a pack that at any moment might, you know, crash into one another? And
most people have ridden in a cycling pack. You've ridden behind somebody on your bike and you're
in the slipstream.
Yeah, you're riding along at, you know, let's say most people can ride along at 30 kilometres an hour. You get a slipstream that makes it markedly easier when you're behind somebody. It's not to the same degree in speed skating, but there is that degree of slipstream advantage of being slightly easier when you're behind another skater. So being able to save energy is a big part of hopefully being at the front at the end of the race.
But you're going how fast at top speed when you're in these races?
Top speed's about 53, 54 kilometres an hour.
Right, just below a car doing the speed limit, in other words, in an Australian suburb.
That's pretty fast when you hit the barrier.
That is pretty fast, yeah. And but when you're in your pack, though, and you're going that fast, I can't imagine what it's like to drive a car where there's only like a couple of centimetres or something on either side of you, in front of you, as you're trying to drive at that speed.
It's all relative, though, isn't it? Because the other skaters around you are doing the same speed, too.
Right. So you're all moving at the same time. How common are crashes in this sport?
crashes are very common, especially once you get towards the final rounds of the event and the skate has become incredibly even. Usually it's the first two that move through to the next round of the competition. So, you know, if you're in the quarterfinals and you're running third on the last lap, there's no point finishing third. You might as well go for a suicide pass and try and make it through to second to get through to the next round, which obviously creates some carnage that goes with it.
Oh, right. So there's that constant calculation of risk and reward at every, and the risk
that's
pretty
like
high,
life, isn't it?
Yeah, but the stakes are really high though in this case. So at 15, you went to Amsterdam. What was it like to participate in an international competition for the first time at that age?
I was the reserve in the national team at that one, but I was incredibly excited and felt lucky to be there to see the sport on an international level. And I remember I watched the Japanese skater in the men's 1,000-meter final. He passed three other skaters on the outside. It took him about 2.5 laps to finally make the pass, and then he gapped them and broke the world record by 0.8 of a second. And his last name was Kawasaki, the same as the motorbike. And I watched him do that, and sitting there in that grandstand, I said to myself, I want to do that. And really, that was the last time in my life I ever needed my dad to push me. I knew that I was going to the Olympics from that moment. It was just a matter of where I was going to finish. And in fact, in a lot of my skating career, I probably needed somebody to tell me when to stop training.
Were Australians taken seriously in the sport at that time, internationally, or even nationally, even domestically and internationally?
We had a long history in short track speed skating. And we actually had the first ever world champion in the sport in 1978. It was an unofficial world championship sport then, but the winner was an Australian man named Jim Lynch. And, you know, we had a long history throughout the 70s and 80s in short track speed skating, and when it became an Olympic sport, official medal sport, the first time in 1992 in Albertville, which was also my first Winter Olympics, we were actually the favourites in the relay to win the gold medal in that one. So,
well, you see, this all comes as a surprise to me, knowing this, because I don't know, I suppose I think, and I suspect many Australians who don't know much about your sport, which is most of us, think that Australians reaching high standards of excellence in a winter sport like this is a bit like thinking that someone from, I don't know, the Himalayas would do well in the pool or something like that. So is this a commonly held misconception that I've had in this matter?
Well, in short track speed skating, we have Olympic-sized ice rinks here in Australia. Whilst the ice conditions may not be the best in the world, there's a place called the Ice House in Melbourne, which is a dual ice rink facility, which is one of the world's leading facilities these days. But the rinks that I trained on, the ice conditions were generally a little bit subpar, but it was still an ice rink, and it enabled you to do the majority of the base work that you needed before you went overseas and got onto the faster ice conditions.
So in 1991, the World Championships were held in Sydney, and you competed and trained and trained and trained. How did you do at that event, Stephen?
Yeah, that was one of the highlights of my sporting career. I'd just turned 17 at that point, and I was the fourth member of the Australian men's relay team, and I combined with John Carr, Richard Nieselski, and Andrew Murtha, who were all more older seasoned competitors. And I mentioned earlier that there was two guys that were left out of the national team that were older and better than me the year before that weren't real happy, and two of those guys were Andrew Murtha and John Carr. So they were back with a vengeance for the World Championships the following year, and I combined with those three guys and we won the World Championships.
You won the World Championship in that event, that relay.
We did. We came from the year before basically being lapped as a relay team against the world champion Dutch team and the Canadians and the Koreans and other countries. And the four of us just all kind of progressed enormously around the same time. And I progressed the most because I was getting much stronger going from 16 to 17 and really training like an elite athlete probably for the first full season in my life. And the progressions I made were enormous. And the other three guys were on fire in that event. I was the slowest of the four, and you know, in some ways, I was able to tag on the back of those three guys and win a gold medal. But at the same time, they wouldn't have won it without me.
So the next year is 1992. You're 17 years old, and you go to your first Winter Olympics, Albertville in France, as part of this relay team. Does that mean you went in as the favourites for that event?
Correct. Yeah, world champions, favourites for the gold medal, and realistically, at that point, there was only three teams that could get the gold medal. It was Australia, Canada, and South Korea. We were streets ahead of the rest of the teams in that event. And unfortunately, in the semi-finals, Richard Jasielski crashed about two-thirds of the way through the event, and that was it.
So these kind of crashes are quite commonplace in the sport.
Yeah, crashes happen very regularly in short track speed skating. You know, you've got that lean angle of 40 degrees and you're trying to get the maximum out of your legs and your equipment, and it doesn't take much to have a stumble. And if the grip doesn't hang on the blade, then it's very hard to hang on to it.
How do competitors from much colder countries treat your presence at the very highest levels of this sport? Are you seen as upstarts or what?
Definitely not. Not anymore. And
back then, though.
No, you know, after we won the World Championships, we'd put ourselves on the map. And, you know, I remember when the draw came out for the semi-finals at the Olympics in Albertville, when we were racing with the South Koreans, when Australia got drawn out, the South Korean team manager chucked his pencil down on the desk because he wasn't happy that he had to race against Australia. And, you know, we had respect of the world in the sport. You know, we were the world champions. Why wouldn't we?
This is at a time when the Winter Olympics would be starting to become more and more popular. What do you think is the appeal of these sports, particularly in countries like Australia, to watch on the telly or even live?
Well, firstly, every sport in the Winter Olympics, with the notable exception of curling, has risk and speed involved with it. And usually that is quite television friendly, exciting to watch. And a lot of the newer events that have been added to the Winter Games more recently are millennial focused. I don't know if that's the right term, but the younger generations love the slope style, the snowboard cross, the half pipe, and short track speed skating certainly fits into that category of an extreme sport. And the younger generations love to watch the speed and the unpredictability of those sports. And the Winter Olympics is definitely headed in the right direction with the sports that it's added over the last decade or so. And Australia punches way above its weight. We've got so many medal contenders for Pyeongchang in February. Hardly anybody knows where the Winter Olympics are, but they're Pyeongchang in Korea, and they're only 2.5 months away.
I suppose it's about as fast as a human being can go without on a device that doesn't have a motor. I suppose when you think about it, isn't it? On skis or skates or in a luge or something like
Did
that.
Did you do any homework on that, Richard?
No, I'm just thinking that. That thought just popped into my head.
You're correct. It's actually, speed skating is the fastest self-propelled sport in the world, meaning no engine, no gravity.
How is it for you being 17 years old wandering around the Olympic Village for the first time?
I was like a chook with his head cut off in a lot of respects. So I had so much potential and ability on the ice, but I spent a lot of time playing pinball machines in the video arcade because they were free, and McDonald's was free, and you know I could go down to the food hall and eat Magnum ice blocks at 11 p.m. at night, and it just
are you allowed to do that? Yeah. There's no trainer saying just go a bit easy on the Maccas and the Magnums before you get into your events.
Yeah, we had people advising us, but I guess we were too stupid to take it.
It's all free and it's all right there, was it? So it's an accepted part of the race then, it sounds to me. Like, as you say, the team crashed out in those Olympics. But it seems to be like this is another thing I didn't understand about speed. It's just an accepted tactical part of the race that you might crash or the other competitors might crash. And you might get caught up or you might get past it then.
Agreed. And probably on average, most skaters would be crashing in training once every 2 to 3 weeks. And that's when you're not pushing yourself at 100% trying to get past other skaters when your legs are tired and, you know, the final lap of a race trying to get through to the next round. So in racing, the crashes are far more common than in training.
So you'd won gold at the World Championships in Sydney, but crashed out in your first Olympics in France there. What, do you remember how you felt at the end of that? What resolve you had at the end of that, having crashed out?
Yeah, well, unfortunately for me, at that point I was out of form and I didn't actually skate in that race in the semi-final, but I was devastated when we were done and the team had no chance of an Olympic medal. I would have loved to have seen the other four guys pick up an Olympic medal, even if I didn't get one. Would have been Australia's first Winter Olympic medal. It, all of us had a lot more time left in the sport, especially me. I was only 17, so I had a lot of unfinished business at that point, and the Winter Games and the Summer Games used to be in the same year up until 1992. We had Barcelona and Albertville then, and it was too expensive for most countries to send two Olympic teams in the same year. So the Winter Olympic Games got split, meaning we had 1992 in Albertville and then 1994 in Lillehammer in Norway. So we only had 2 years until the next Winter Olympics, and there was no way that any of the guys in our team were going to hang up their skates prior to having another shot at it.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler, podcast, broadcast, and online.
Stephen, you went to the Winter Olympics again, like you said, in 1994 to compete at Lillehammer in Norway, and you were part of the short track relay team. What was the plan for you and the guys at Lillehammer?
To qualify in the relay for the Olympic Games, you have to make it into the top eight relay teams in the world, which is a competitive environment to begin with to get into the best eight. And so once we did that, we knew that we were one of the strongest teams in the world, and we had a pretty solid chance to make amends from what had happened in Albertville in 92 and hopefully win Australia's first Winter Olympic medal. That was the plan. We had the possibility of getting a gold, but that didn't eventuate. As it turned out, we were able to pick up the bronze, and it was a pretty amazing couple of weeks. And I remember we came back to Australia and had people recognising us for a week or two, and we were the flavour of the month. So for a winter sport in a Australian summer country to be on the map for a moment or two was exhilarating for the whole team.
Again, in the individual events this time, you, because of your qualifying times beforehand, you went into your individual events as a favourite to win, didn't you?
I did, yeah. The 1,000 metres was the best event that I had to compete in at the Olympics. The 1,500 metres hadn't been added at that point, which I was arguably stronger at. But in the 1,000 metres, I was one of the big favourites to get a medal or get a gold medal in that event. And, yeah, things definitely didn't go in my favour. I was arguably intentionally taken out in the first round of the competition.
How so?
A skater from Belgium skated up the inside of me and fell over in front of me going into the corner and took out my legs. So whether he did it intentionally or not, I'll never be 100% sure, but partly it was my fault because I shouldn't have allowed myself to get into that position, but that didn't change the fact that I was out in the first round of the competition as one of the favourites. Fortunately, though, winning the bronze medal in the relay was able to put some of those not-so-good Olympic memories to bed and put them in the back of my mind.
How psychologically robust do you have to be to go into an event like that as the favourite and be taken out in a crash, intentional or otherwise, where, you know, the prospect of victory is dangled in front of you? In the end, though, your race ends with this incredibly painful collision with the crash barrier.
I think, like in life, you just have to be realistic. Things don't always turn out the way that you want them to.
No, you don't always hit a crash barrier at 50Ks, though, do you, on ice skates?
You know, you've just got to keep getting back up. And the way the rules were in the sport back then, they've been changed since. If another skater committed a disqualifiable offence against you and it wasn't inside the last two laps of the race, then you were not able to be advanced to the next round of the competition. And he took me out with seven laps to go. The speed had hardly even picked up yet. And so the rules since that point had been changed, and people used to exploit the rules prior to that because there was gaps in them.
1994, during the World Cup event in Montreal, what happened that day, Stephen?
Yeah, I was unfortunate enough to crash with probably the two best skaters in the world at that point, and myself being in the mix with those two was Mark Gagnon and Fred Blackburn, two Canadian guys, and I landed on the back of Fred Blackburn's blade at 50 kilometres an hour, and it skewered my right leg. It went into my right quad on the outside. I did sort of a sideways flip in the air and landed bang on the back of his blade, and it went clean through my right leg in one side, out the other, and ripped straight back out.
Oh, it didn't slash you. It impaled you?
Correct, yeah. Now, a person of my size, I have 5.5 litres of blood, and I lost four of them in 60 seconds. So you could imagine the mess on the ice at that point.
Did you pass out? You would have had to have passed out, I suppose, losing that much blood.
I didn't. I refused to. I kind of made a pact with myself lying there on the ice because my whole body was in shock. My eyes were closing. I said to myself, if I lose consciousness, I'm going to die. And honestly, Richard, I got to tell you, it is amazing the amount of power that a human being, any human being, can draw upon when they're put into a life and death situation like that. If I could have drawn on that sort of power every day in my training, I never would have lost. And I've always been a pretty positive person, but after I came back to the sport after that injury, I was able to draw on that sometimes. If I was having a tough day in training and the legs were just hurting and felt like it was all too hard, I'd try and think back to when I was lying on the ice in Canada with 3/4 of my own blood spilled around me, and the bad day in training didn't seem so bad anymore.
Is it not uncommon for people to die on the rink in this sport?
That is very uncommon. I've heard it unofficially happening once to a girl in Korea, but in speed skating, there isn't that many injuries. The barriers are padded, so if you hit side on or back on, you don't have a problem. If you hit feet first, well, you try and learn very quickly to not hit the barrier feet first if you've fallen. So there isn't that many injuries, but usually when there is one, when you've got 18-inch knives doing 50 kilometres an hour flying through the air, then it's a pretty good injury.
All the muscles for this sport are in your legs, aren't they, in your thighs. What muscle damage did that accident do to your legs?
Oh, the question is, what muscle damage didn't it do? Out of 4 out of 4 quad muscles were sliced in half, the iliotibial band, the femoral vein, and 2 of the tributaries to the femoral artery. The femoral artery was missed by 1 millimetre. If the blade had have hit that or even nicked it, I would have bled out in probably 30 seconds.
All this happened 8 years before Salt Lake City. 8 years. How long does it take to recover, just let alone be able to walk, let alone compete in your sport again?
I was never able to get all the explosive power back into my leg. I was able to get all the strength back, and I actually made it stronger than what it was prior to when it got cut open. But that explosion, that spring-like reaction that some athletes have, I lost a little bit of that power, but I just forgot about that. I had a lot of unfinished business to take care of.
How long in rehab?
I spent about 3.5 weeks in hospital, and because it was all muscle damage, you know, they had 111 stitches in my leg, and once they were all taken out, the muscles were on the road to recovery, and I was able to basically get straight back into exercise and training, but it took me probably 18 months to get all the strength back in my leg.
Were you a bit gun-shy putting the skates back on?
Momentarily. Until I stepped foot on the ice for the first time, then I was fine.
So then you get to the Olympics, 1998. You're back at the Olympics competing after having your quadriceps sliced as badly as it was in Nagano in Japan. You crashed out again, but you were a very serious prospect for the gold, even despite your injuries. Do Australians know this about you, Stephen, that you competed at that level?
Yeah, well, it wasn't my first time strapping on a pair of skates and winding up in the final at the Olympics in Salt Lake City. As you're mentioning here, I had a lot of history in the sport, and the Nagano Olympics in 98 were definitely a part of my skating history that I try not to dwell on because I just didn't skate well.
Yeah, it seems like that's just the risk you have to accept about the sport. Again, I'm making the point that again and again you're getting to the starting line at this the highest level of this elite sport. I just don't know if Australians know that about you, Stephen, that you did this again and again and again. You won gold in relays with world championships, bronze at the Olympics before that.
Well, I think for me, probably the thing that I struggled with the most in my skating career was being able to find my peak at the right time. You know, sometimes I broke world records in training and I skated incredible sets and lap times in training in September, you know, skated really well at the Australian National Championships and won the title. But by the time I got to World Championships the following March, I just wasn't skating at my peak at the right time. And I think that's where the skaters who beat me most of the time, the top guys in the world, were able to judge when the best in themselves came out when they needed it at the right time. And for me, I found it here or there at the World Championships or at the Olympics, but I was never able to put a finger on it, how to get the peak right.
So your eyes are now set on 2002 in Salt Lake City, and then in training for that, there was another accident. Can you explain what happened on that day?
Yeah, that was out at Ice World at Acacia Ridge, where I spent a lot of my life doing laps around the big fridge out there, as I used to call it. But, yeah, it was a very innocuous training crash. I kind of just skated into another guy, went over the top of him and wound up going headfirst into the barrier. And my chin was pushed right down onto my chest and my right arm, basically the whole right side of my body, my right leg and everything had pins and needles right through it. And so, you know, that's a neck injury straight up. And a lady by the name of Anne McNee, who's the mum of a couple of the other guys I used to race against, was a nurse, and she recognised what it was straight away and basically immobilised me and called the ambulance. And the next thing I knew, I'd been diagnosed with a fractured C4, C5, or if you want to take the technicality out of it, a broken neck, and they screwed a halo brace into my head, which has two pins in the front, two pins in the back, which they screw into your, push into your skull, and then a ring around the top, which is why they call it a halo brace. So I pretty much resembled a human building site for a couple of months.
You obviously couldn't train while you were wearing that either, could you? Or did you?
I couldn't skate because I couldn't watch where I was going, but I was still able to push weights in the gym, and I spent an incredible amount of time on the stationary bike in my house at home, just pumping out intervals and pumping out pedal after pedal after pedal to keep my fitness up during that time.
Wearing a halo brace.
Yeah, and it has chest and back plates that the head construction zone part of it bolt onto, and they're woolen lined. So you could imagine how I smelt doing all of those miles on the training bike with woolen lined chest and back plates.
What did your mum make of you watching you train like that?
Yeah, my mum, she didn't say it in as many words, but at that point in my skating career, I could tell by the look on her face that she wanted me to quit. I'd almost bled to death, and now I was lucky not to be in a wheelchair. And in fact, there was a lot of people around me at that time that were telling me it was time to hang up the skates. But
what about your doctors?
Yeah, well, for me, that was never a question. In my head, and I had 2.5 months wearing the halo brace, and I had the whole time to think about the big picture. I had nothing else to do. And I decided that once the halo brace is removed, I've only got 18 months to go until the next Olympics, and 18 months of hard work out of 14 years is not that much. If I don't do it, I'm going to kick myself for the rest of my life. So I've got to have one last shot at it. And the doctor who screwed the halo brace into my head did not agree with that. He told me I'd never skate again. I just packed up my stuff and went to another doctor.
So travelling to Salt Lake City in 2002 for this event, you were a man who'd just recovered from a broken neck. And years before that...
Well, I wouldn't say just recovered. That was 18 months earlier.
Yeah, no, that's just recovered, I reckon. I don't think you say, oh, yeah, I broke my neck a couple of weeks ago, but gee, that was a bit funny, wasn't it? No, that's still just recovered, I think, isn't it? I mean, so you pushed your way through all of that to get to Salt Lake City in the first place. Were you optimistic when you arrived there nonetheless?
I was incredibly excited and optimistic for sure. It was a different mindset in Salt Lake City than what it was in my previous three Olympics. During that time where I was wearing the halo brace, I set myself a new goal. I've always been one who talks about setting goals and set goals for myself. My goal through the first three Olympics was to get a gold medal. That hadn't happened, and realistically it wasn't going to. The new goal was to get to that next Olympics in Salt Lake City and skate my best. And my best realistically wasn't medals anymore. I just wanted to do my best once every 4 years when the whole world was finally watching a speed skater from Brisbane.
As a solo competitor, were you surprised to make it to the final?
If you had have asked me prior to the competition if I'd be in the final and I'd take a fifth place out of this event, I would have taken it.
What was the calibre of opponent like that you were up against in that final race?
Well, the other four skaters were four of probably seven or eight skaters in the world that even on my best day I simply couldn't beat anymore.
Were you older than most of them?
I was the oldest guy, not just in the final, the oldest skater in the entire Olympic field. And in speed skating, you get about 25 minutes rest between each round. So you've got the heats, the quarters, the semi-finals and the final all in about an hour and a half. And so for me, I had one or two good races in me in a night. But after that, I probably needed a day off until I could come back reinvigorated.
Oh,
but
so you'd spent your money, if you like, on just getting to the final then?
Yeah, my chips were cashed, mate. In the quarterfinal, I beat a Canadian guy by the name of Marc Gagnon. Hadn't beaten that prick for 8 years. And, my chips were cashed at that point, Richard. And, from there in the semifinals, I skated well, but not well enough to be able to mix it with the other guys, but I still had some reasonable legs in the semi-final, and as it turned out, three of them fell over on the last corner, and I spoke with my coach prior to the final and looked at the other names, and I said to her, I don't think I can beat any of these blokes. Little Chinese lady, her name is Ann Zhang, and she agreed with me.
Going into that final race, the men's 1,000 metre, do you have a ritual? Did you have anything you said to yourself to steady your nerve and make you confident before the race?
I don't know if it's a ritual, but one thing that I always used to tell myself was to go smooth, because as I said at the start, skating smooth is skating fast. But for that final, knowing that I was going in there with a different tactic to the other four, my coach and I knew that the other four skaters in the final were interested in a gold medal. None of them wanted to finish second, and that meant that there was a reasonable chance of two guys getting mixed up, one getting disqualified, one going down, and me being left with a bronze medal and standing on the podium, and that would have been amazing. So
you went into that race with that as a strategy, in a way, that the competition for gold would be so intense that there was a good chance, that they'd all end up, or one or more would end up in a tangle and crash out.
Oh, that was the only strategy I felt I could have, Richard. Yeah. I wasn't as strong as the other four, so mixing it up with them in the first two-thirds of the race was simply pointless. And that could only amount to me getting involved in some collision with them and maybe taking away the small chance of picking up a medal through other people's mistakes that I had.
So what was your state of mind then going into the race? Was it strangely calm? It sounds like it.
It was. I was really soaking up the atmosphere before the final. As you can imagine, there's not too many people that are coming to watch me do laps down at Acacia Ridge in Brisbane for training. So when you get to the Olympics and you've got a 16,500 strong crowd in the Utah Jazz basketball stadium in Salt Lake City, you're making the most of that opportunity and just soaking up that atmosphere. I knew it was my last Olympics, and to be in the final was pretty bloody special.
What do you remember after the starting gun went off?
I knew my tactic. I knew I was going straight to the back and I was just going to hang on to the other four as long as I could. So the first 7.5 laps of the race, I hung on to the other four. And unfortunately, from there, the legs started to get tired. And for me, that had never really happened before. I knew that I wasn't going to be able to mix it with them. But to drop off out of the slipstream was something that I hadn't experienced in my career really ever. And so, you know, once you get more than about 3 metres behind the pack, you lose that slipstream, and then you've got that elastic band effect where once the elastic band's broken and you're out of the slipstream, it's all over very quickly. So, you know, I went from 3 or 4 metres behind to 10 or 12 metres behind very quickly over the course of the last lap and a half. And, you know, from there, I'd kind of resigned myself to finishing fifth, which I would have been pretty darn happy with. And then heading into the last corner, I saw the Chinese guy try and make a move and it didn't work and he fell, and I thought, well, that's fourth. That's not really any better than fifth. And I set up my final turn, and from there the other three skaters all got tangled up, and out of the corner of my eye I saw them all into the pads, squashed up against the barrier, and I knew that I didn't have to skate anymore. All I had to do was glide, and I wasn't sure if I should celebrate or hide. I had no idea what the appropriate response was, and most people have seen the race. They saw the look on my face, and that pretty much tells the story.
Do you know, when you know how it's going to pan out and you see it, when you watch the video again, it almost looks like they've all up front, they've gone, come on, let's crash out and give Stephen a go. You know, it almost looks like that. They've spilled because they clear a way for you almost, for you to sail so gracefully through the middle of that, and then your arms sort of raise up very gently. It's kind of like a victory gesture, but it's not like pumping the air.
Oh, definitely
not. It's you sort of got your arms in the air. Is that like receiving a gift or something? Is that what it is?
Well, I suppose at that moment, that's sort of what it felt like. And initially, I wasn't sure if I wanted to accept the gold medal under those circumstances. You know, as we've been through, I had chances to win in previous Olympics and they didn't work out. But a gift is probably not the right description, and the biggest thing that it felt like after the race was relief. There was 3 or 4 minutes where the judges were kind of huddled together in the middle of the ice, and there was a dull hum over the crowd of 16,500 people because nobody knew what was going to happen. I don't think the judges even knew what they were going to do, because if that crash had happened with, say, 2 laps to go, they would have stopped the race, had a look at the video, disqualified the person who they deemed had caused the crash, and then raced it again. But because it happened right on the last corner, right before the finish line, I'd gone across the line. Two of the other guys had gotten up and basically slid across the line. So the distance was complete. So if the distance is complete, you can't race the race again. So that was going in my favour as well. And all the other skaters had gotten off the race, gotten off the ice. A couple of them had small injuries. The Canadian guy had cut his buttock a little bit, so there was a little blood, little bit of blood on the ice, and the Chinese and the Korean guy had fallen over, and no one knew it was going to happen, and I was the last guy out there on the ice, and I thought, well, if they announce me the gold medal winner here, which I think they're going to, there's no way that I'm grabbing the Australian flag and doing a victory lap, so I'm going to get off too. Just after I got off the ice, the official announcement came through, and the Jumbotron was there in the stadium, and it had my name with the gold medal next to it. I knew that was the official announcement, and I just looked up. I wasn't looking up to God or anything like that, but I just sort of breathed out like I'd never breathed out before, and it felt like there was 2 or 3 seconds right there that had been carved out of time just for me.
What was the crowd like, the American crowd of Americans? Because one of those races that was knocked out was American. How unhappy were they that you won
gold? The majority of the crowd was booing.
That's not very classy of them, is it?
Well, they wanted the American to win, and they were disappointed that he was involved in the collision, and he was on his way to get the gold medal, and the Chinese guy was the one that did the foul play and was disqualified.
Yeah, but why boo you? I mean, you hadn't done anything.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think the American crowd was booing me particularly. They were just booing because the American Apollo Ono didn't win.
So there it was. You'd won the gold. You were the first Australian to win gold. And it was seen as this act of effortlessness and flukiness, and it kind of appeals to... I think it's a bit like, you know, when you win the Melbourne Cup or something and you haven't done any effort to win money or something like that. It was seen like that. Like I say, though, how aware do you think Australians are that you'd had all that intensity and victory and training and triumph over adversity and recovery from injury to get you there in the first place, Stephen?
Well, as you know, Richard, speed skating isn't on the television in this country, aside from when the Winter Olympics are on every 4 years. So there would have been very few people in Australia who remembered 8 years earlier when I was in the relay team where we picked up the bronze medal. Mm. And very few people would have even known that I'd competed in 4 Olympic Games. So
does it spoil the joke to know that about you, I wonder? Is that the problem there? It spoils the joke.
I don't know. Well, I suppose in Australia, the tall poppy syndrome is all too prevalent, isn't it? Mm. Sometimes some people just want to knock you down, and that's one of the bad things about Australian culture. But for me, you know, these questions you're throwing at me now are questions that most people ask if I do an interview around, does it piss you off that people only think you won because you were lucky? But nobody actually says that. People realise that you don't wind up in the final of the Olympic Games because you haven't worked hard to get there. Most people realise that.
Are you celebrated as an underdog?
Most definitely. Yeah, we've got the saying in 2014 that was added into the Macquarie Dictionary doing a Bradbury. It gets used more and more every year, and I hope they're still using it when I'm dead.
You do a lot of motivational speaking these days. What do people still love about your story?
You know, my story, I think, is a prime example that if you're willing to give all of yourself to something, because, you know, I believe to succeed in today's world, you've got to be an expert in one thing. Today's world is too competitive to be a jack of all trades. You've got to be very, very good at something and focus on it and train hard and do it all the time to become an expert in whatever it is that you're passionate about. You know, and for me, I did that in speed skating. And, you know, when I've spoken at over 1,000 conferences in 19 countries, and I enjoy the adrenaline that goes with being on stage, and I talk about things like teamwork, goal setting, and positive mindset.
You've got 3 kids. Do they skate?
Yeah, love my kids. They're a big job, though. My wife and I had 3 kids under the age of 2. We had twins the second time around, and, mate, I've got to tell you, the first couple of years, bringing up 3 kids in nappies felt like training for the Olympics was a walk in the park. So will they be skaters? Probably not. I'd prefer my kids to get into activities and sports that are a little bit more popular in Australia. I'm trying to push my son Flynn into tennis these days because I love my tennis, and I'd love to see him get a stranglehold of that game.
You were saying there that you think that to get ahead, you really have to specialise intensely in one thing. But you miss out on a lot when you do that. Are you doing that now? What do you do with your life now that broadens you out a bit? Intense application.
Seriously, you think you miss out on a lot if you specialise in something?
But you don't sound like you feel like you've missed out on anything.
Definitely not. I mean, until you're willing to give all of yourself to something, there's a lot of things in there which I like to call the one percenters. And someone who hasn't given all of themselves to something for a long time hasn't even uncovered what they are. You know, they're those little expert things that make you better than anyone else. You've got to give all of yourself to something and don't give up at it, because once you uncover those little one percenters and you get some of that adrenaline flowing around in your stomach every day, it doesn't feel like work anymore.
So great to speak with you, Stephen. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Richard.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
Since we last spoke in 2018, so much has changed in Stephen's life. As part of his reinvention, Stephen's started a beer company called Last Man Standing Australian Lager. Stephen's son, Flynn, isn't into tennis after all. Turns out he's into playing rugby and guitar. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Langoth Black Mountain. Armadural.
Yeah, so,
yeah, you get that double look, like, really?
One night they just kick the door down.
I only get to Walcha by 5 p.m.
I'm trying to flush the heroin down the loo.
It looks, in some ways it looks like a light bulb with a little antenna. In other ways it looks kind of like, it looks like a sex toy.
From hunting for thylacines in the Tasmanian wilderness.
It's a quadruped. Stocky. It's got the right shaped ears.
To chasing a Russian spy through Sydney streets.
And then Sergei pulled out a $50 bill and then dropped his trousers.
From an avalanche to an addiction.
You're literally hearing the sound of two pieces of the planet shifting against each other.
And a mad dash down the coast in some of the worst floods in living memory.
One night in Tamworth, up at 5 a.m. Wallaby dark.
You will find laughs, you will find danger. These are real Australian stories, and everyone comes with a little twist.
I go, yeah, I'm just going to buy a one-way ticket.
Just search for Days Like These in your favourite podcast app.
And, yeah, that's a vision that you're not going to get out of your mind anytime soon.
So join me, Elizabeth Coolass, for more stories about the moment when everything changes.